When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can seem intense. Like breakup R&B intense.
I thought you said you loved the sweater that I got you. If you didn't, you could have told me.
Geico makes it easy. Just go to Geico.com anytime to update or check your policy without all the extra drama.
I even had a gift receipt.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, I realized recently, dumb me, that my vitamin D, which I was taking at night before I went to bed, was waking me up repeatedly at night. Well, I like a good night's sleep as much as the next person, so I started taking it in the morning, or that is, I intended to, but I kept forgetting. That is, until this week, when I read Smart Change by my guest tonight, Dr. Art Markman, and I moved my vitamin D bottle inside my coffee jar. I did this because it turns out the environment supporting behavior can be integral to changing or maintaining behavior. I learned this from his book. Now, I have to force myself to have contact with that bottle first thing, and now I can't get to my coffee scoop without going through that bottle, which, you know, I open it, I take the pill. So my guest tonight, psychology and marketing professor Dr. Art Markman, will explain how our human motivational system works and how you can use this knowledge to be effective in instilling positive behaviors and doing the hardest thing to do, breaking bad habits and keeping them broken. His very helpful book we'll be discussing tonight is Smart Change, Break the Habits That Hold You Back and Form the Habits of Success. Hello, Art.
Hey, Amy. It's great to be here.
I'm so glad you're here because this was very helpful. I think other people will find it helpful. But let's start with the problems we have changing our behavior. You make the point that, for example, we know how to stay healthy. We just don't do it.
Yeah, scary, isn't it? I mean, you know, the fact is, think about losing weight. I mean, is there anyone on the planet who doesn't know that the key to losing weight is to take in fewer calories than you're burning? I mean, we all understand how to do that, and yet we don't do it. And there's several really important reasons for that. And the first of them really is that we as human beings are wired to do the thing that feels good for us in the short term. And so we go ahead and we develop these habits to do the thing that feels good now. And so we discount. We don't pay attention to all the stuff that's going to happen to us in the future. And so what happens is we end up creating a set of behaviors and ultimately a set of habits that get in the way of doing what we really ought to be doing.
And now you write that most of our psychological mechanisms are devoted to maintaining established behaviors rather than changing them.
That's right. You know, the funny thing is about our habit system is, you know, most of us have tried to change our habits before, and what happens when we do that is we assume our brain must be broken because we can't figure out how to make changes. But in fact, the reason why we have so much trouble changing our behavior is because of how good our brain is at creating habits and then maintaining those habits. Because ultimately, the brain is a very expensive organ to operate. It's about 3% of our body weight. It uses 20 to 25% of our daily energy supply. And that's really just the amount of energy that's required to keep the lights on. And so what that means is that we really want to minimize the amount of time that we spend deliberating about our behaviors, because every moment that we waste is energy that we're wasting. So what we do is we develop these habits that tell us exactly what we're supposed to do in a particular environment and allow us to do as much of our daily routine mindlessly as possible. And that's a great thing from an energy standpoint, but every once in a while when we get a behavior that really is not doing us any good anymore, that's the point at which that real efficiency of the habit system gets in our way.
Now, I was very interested in how you talked about this trade-off between effort and accuracy that our brain needs to resolve. You sort of touched on that a little bit with how our brain develops these sort of habits where we don't have to think about things so much. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. If you think about it, because the brain is really trying to do the best job it can to minimize energy, and really minimizing energy, it means minimizing the amount of time you spend on things. What we'd like to do is to spend as little time as possible doing anything that we're doing while still being accurate enough to survive. And that's why, you know, if you go to the local pharmacy and you stand in front of the candy bars that are there, you know, you could deliberate for an hour and a half over the candy bar you ought to get. But it just doesn't matter if you get a peak candy experience. And so you stand there and you deliberate for at least 10 seconds before you pick something. But if you're going to buy a new car or a new house or something that has real lasting implications for you, then you're going to spend more time on it in an effort to try and be more accurate at making that decision. And so we make that trade-off all the time. And our habits allow us to speed up that process and to do what has been the right thing to do in the past fairly quickly.
This is this autopilot thing a lot of us get into where you have a habit, you're not focusing, you need to do something a little differently. You wrote about you needed to bring some food to a grad student dissertation defend. A grad student was defending their dissertation. You bring out everybody food, and it was really hard for you to do that.
Oh, it's terrible. You know, I mean, whenever you have to break your routine, you know, I routinely find myself, you know, halfway out the door before I realize there was something else I was supposed to bring. And this actually relates to your great opening example. It turns out if you stick your keys in the refrigerator, then it forces you to break your routine because you stick your keys right on top of the food that you're going to bring. And now, you know, what happens is you actually manage to get to the car before you realize, you know, it would be helpful to have the keys right about now. And because you've broken the routine, you now have to stand up and go, right, the keys are in the refrigerator with the food. And then you manage to remember some of the things that deviate from your habit. And that's really a crucial bit. You know, we'll get to this later, I'm sure, but the environment plays such a big role in driving our habits that if you want to help to break those habits, one of the things you have to do is to muck around with your environment.
Yeah, that part of your book is so fascinating, but we have a lot of stuff to cover before, like you said. And one thing that was fascinating to me and that I know, and it was reinforced by your book, you say that what makes behavior change difficult is that you want to change a behavior even though the old behavior is still technically successful. Like your old eating behavior is working as far as your motivational system is concerned, your body is concerned. You want to eat, and you eat.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, you know, I just moved to a new house a couple of months ago, and so none of my routines for turning on light switches and where to put, you know, remembering where to put my mail and all that stuff, none of those work anymore. And so I didn't have any trouble developing new habits because I couldn't do any of the things that I used to do before. But years ago when I really needed to lose weight, well, that was a lot harder because, you know, as you say, right, technically speaking, your motivational system is perfectly happy with the amount of food that you're eating. It's only you when you look in the mirror that aren't so happy about it. And that's really the case where you end up having to fight against that habit system, because now you need to find a way to overwrite a whole set of habits that you've laid down before. Because if you don't do that, if you don't really change the relationship between the environment that you've got and the behaviors you're trying to perform, then you're going to just keep doing the thing that you've done in the past.
Now, you talk about these two big hurdles to changing behavior in your book, Smart Change, and you got into one that your brain wants to conserve energy, so it likes to do what you already did and seem to be successful. And then the other thing is wanting things right now. You say that we're creatures. This is what we are. We want things right now, and you talk about the Ten Commandments, how they're mostly about impulse control in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's the funny thing. I give talks on this kind of thing all the time, and several years ago I was talking about how it is that we really are wired to do the thing that feels good right now. And a woman in the audience said to me, well, isn't that just a part of the modern era? Isn't it just the current generation that's really causing that? And this is a version of what I like to call the world is going to hell in a handbasket question. And so I said, look, you know, if you look at our Judeo-Christian heritage, and you say, what's our cultural top 10 list? It's the 10 commandments. And if you pull out a couple of them that have to do with follow this commandment rather than that one, every single one of them is really about resolving the trade-off between doing what's right in the short term and doing what's right in the long term in favor of the long term, right? So that person who just annoyed you, don't kill him. That shiny thing that somebody else owns, don't steal it. That very beautiful spouse of the person living next door, leave him or her alone. Right, and it's very important to remember that as commandments, the Ten Commandments actually didn't work, right? Because here it is, the deity came down and said, don't do these things. And yet, look around, people are still doing them because we're so strongly wired to do the thing that feels right in the short term that even a deity coming down and telling you to do something isn't enough to get you to stop.
Yeah, even if he'll smite you, it still isn't going to stop
That's
you
right.
from going after
That's
the neighbor's
right.
wife.
Smite it thou. Yeah.
Yeah, smite it thou. I always like that language. You have some really smart strategies in your book, Smart Change, and these are all about supporting attempts to prevent some old undesirable behavior from happening, to maintain a new behavior. And in this, you talk about some of the nuances of that. And one of them that I found very interesting was that there's a good way and a bad way to fail.
Well, you know, it's funny. In this country, in this era, we have a very strange relationship with failure. We learn from a very early age that failure is bad. You know, you go to school and you make a mistake on a test, you get a big red X on the paper, and that tells you failure is wrong. But in fact, failure is a necessary part of life, and some of those failures are actually really good. So let's talk about the good failure first, and then we'll figure out the bad one, right? One of the good failures is, you know, you mentioned earlier this idea of a trade-off between effort and accuracy. Well, how in the world do you figure out this trade-off between effort and accuracy? The way you do it is every once in a while you got to do something wrong. You have to spend not quite enough time to do something accurately and then discover, you know, I should have spent more time on this. That's the only way you learn where the line is. If you never fail, if you never do anything wrong, you're probably spending too much time on everything. So we have to fail that way. And the other thing is we have to fail because life is just too busy. There isn't enough time and money and energy to do everything we want to do when we want to do it, which means that we have to learn to fail unsystematically. You know, if you think about it, if people are going to, you know, skip out on work early to go hear their kids recital one day, and then they're going to make sure they go to the gym, but maybe they're going to have somebody else pick up their kid, and then they're going to stay late at work, and they're going to miss dinner at home. And so in each case, there were trade-offs between these goals, but as long as you were failing in a kind of unsystematic way, it means you're doing your best to juggle all the balls that you have in the air. And that's the good way to fail. And the bad way to fail is to fail systematically, to have situations where systematically there's something that you really want to do and you're not doing it. So this trade-off between short-term and long-term is one of the big sources of this systematic failure, because if you keep doing the thing that feels right in the short-term, then you never perform any of the behaviors you need to perform in order to do the things that are going to be good for you in the long-term.
Now, at what point, though, does that make you feel like such a screw-up that you want to change?
Well, you know, it's a different time. It's different for everybody, right? But I think that you know, and that's actually an important part of this. It's quite difficult to get someone to change if they don't want to change. You know, we all know that old joke about how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. And you know, there is some truth in that, right? At some point, each of us has to wake up one day and say, you know what, now's the time when I'm willing to put in that effort to make some changes in my behavior. Because, you know, there wouldn't have had to have been another, you know, five or six chapters in my book after describing the problem if it were easy to change behavior. It's a lot of work, and you have to be willing to do it.
Well, I do like how you take apart our brain, our motivational system, because it really showed me what I needed to do, like with the vitamins. When we come back, I want to talk about that motivational system. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Art Markman, and his book is Smart Change, Break the Habits That Hold You Back and Form the Habits of Success. And I just want to mention my own book, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck. It's coming out this week. Please buy a copy so I can pay my electric bill. I know, it's so exciting. I'm so thrilled. Worked really hard on it. It's funny, it's science-based, and I hope you like it. So back to our show, our motivational system. Give us a little tour of our motivational system.
Sure. So, you know, one of the amazing things about the motivational system is that we have remarkably little insight into how our own motivational system works. I mean, this is in some ways why so many people need therapy, because we are blissfully unaware of exactly how it is that that motivational system works, and we often need people who are trained in this to look at us from the outside and give us advice about what to do. Now, here's the way the system works. If you think about a brain, if you've never seen a brain before, it looks sort of like two boxing gloves set the wrong way around with the thumbs on the outside, and then they're kind of bumpy. The outer part of the brain is gray in color, so, of course, we call it gray matter. If you cut into a brain a little bit, a couple of millimeters down, it goes from gray to white. Obviously, we call that the white matter. That white matter is a bunch of wiring harnesses that carry signals from one area of the brain to another. If you keep slicing inside the brain, though, deeper and deeper, you come to some other structures that are also made out of this gray matter deep inside the brain. Those structures that are deep inside the brain have many different functions, but one of the key functions is that they help to create and maintain habits. They're part of circuits that really develop these habits, and the purpose of them is to engage our goals, which are the things that we want to see to bring about in the world, or the things that we want to avoid bringing about. They take our goals, they engage them, they give them some energy, and then on the basis of that energy, they drive behavior. And because they're driving behavior forward, I call that entire system the go system, because it's the system that makes you go and do stuff. And then on top of that system, literally on top of it, this brain that's built on top of it, there's a set of other mechanisms, many of which involve some circuits in the area that's just above your eyes. So if you were to press through your eyes, you'd hit this area of your brain. And that area of the brain involves some circuits that stop you from doing things when you've started down the track that you don't want to, and you don't want to perform that behavior. So, you know, you have this, you engage the goal to eat that lovely single-serving carton of Ben and Jerry's that's sitting in your freezer, and now you have this other system that stops you from doing that. And so I call that system the stop system. And so when you want to change your behavior, you need to take into account that you have goals that are going to be driving your behavior. Those goals are going to be energized by the go system. And every once in a while, when you have a behavior that the go system energizes and you don't really want to do it, then you have to engage that stop system to stop you from doing the thing that you don't want to do. And that, in a nutshell, is the structure of that motivational system.
And we're going to come to some details about the stop system, which unfortunately isn't so great at stopping us as the go system is making us go. You say that our go system is constantly on the lookout for ways to take goals that we achieve often and turn them into routines. Like we were talking about before, this is how we get on autopilot, so we can perform them quickly without thinking about them. So, you know, in other words, the go system is looking for ways to create habits.
Yeah, you are a habit creation machine, and not just you, Amy. Everyone listening is a habit creation machine. I actually talk about, when I teach undergraduate classes, I tell my students all the time that the brain is designed as much as possible not to think. A lot of what we're trying to do is to take all of these routines and really find any situation in which we consistently perform a behavior in a particular environment and then repeat that behavior in that environment and compile it away into those brain systems deep inside the brain and use that to create habits that will drive our behavior mindlessly from there on out. And so that's what we do, and the system is constantly on the lookout for that. Now, sometimes we create opportunities to do that, and we call it practice. But even if we don't go out of our way to practice it, if we repeat the behavior in the situation, then we get the habit.
I just have to repeat what you said before. This is one of these little gems in your book. The brain is designed basically to not think, to avoid thinking, because it's too much work. We have a lazy brain.
Yeah.
It's sort of amazing.
Absolutely.
And now you write that go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, all right. We could develop a habit of this. You write that the formula for developing a habit is straightforward, and that all you need is something called consistent mapping and repetition. So tell us about consistent mapping.
Sure. That consistent mapping is basically the environment needs to be in a consistent relationship to the behavior that you're trying to perform. So think about some of the devices that you use all the time that do a good job of creating that. So, for example, your car. When you sit down in your car, your gas pedal, your brake pedal are always in the same place. And because they're always in the same place, whenever you want to move the car forward, you press the gas pedal. Whenever you want to stop, you press the brake pedal. They're always in the same place. And as a result, you can develop a habit to do that. If every time you sat down in your car, somebody flipped around where the gas and brake was in a kind of random way, then you'd never be able to develop a habit. You'd sit down in the car, and then the brake lights in the car would go on in front of you while you're driving down the road. And by the time you figured out which pedal to hit, you'd probably be sitting in the front seat of the car next to you. So you need to have that consistent mapping. And sometimes we create those, but sometimes that's just the way the world is. You know, if you think about a route that you walk to and from your house to some other place, you know, the world itself doesn't change so fast. And so all of that consistency would allow you to take a walk in through your neighborhood and do it really on autopilot, even though you never went out of your way to develop a habit to do that.
And you actually make the point that the environment can be the outside world, but can also be the internal world, your thoughts, your feelings, besides, you know, the street outside your house.
Oh, absolutely. That's right. That internal world is so important. And we develop all kinds of thinking habits, you know, and some of them are great. So we're very good at solving problems generally, and we've developed habits to do things like basic arithmetic, even though, frankly, it took several years of our lives early on to be able to develop that habit. But then again, we have other habits that can get us into trouble. So there are times in your life when you're sad about something, and you can develop habits to kind of get into a cycle of negative thoughts. And that's just as much of a habit as the habit to flick on the light switch or to drive your car.
And, you know, I watch these people checking their email on their phones. Now, I mean, these people, they're not, you know, they don't have the button to push for the missile defense. You know, I mean, maybe they got something from a 14-year-old, maybe, you know. And, you know, it really does seem to be one of those things where people are very automatic. And you point out that the smartphone creates consistent mapping for you. The buttons are in the same place, the icons. It's very comfortable.
Oh, it's very comfortable, and we actually create the perfect storm for habits with things like smartphones, because you know, back in the day, if you when I took intro psych in the 80s, I actually got a rat to train. And you know, the ideal way to train a rat is, you know, you give it water as a reward, and it you know, eventually when it finally learns to press the bar, the ideal thing to do is to get it pressing the bar so that you reward it more or less randomly about 40-50% of the time that it presses the bar. You do that, and that rat will keep pressing the bar over and over and over again. And that's more or less what we've done with ourselves with our smartphones. You pick up that smartphone, everything, it's a consistent mapping, all the buttons are in the same place, and you pick it up in order to check it so that you get a new message about a half the time that you pick it up. And that's one of the reasons why you are, you know, very, very deeply addicted to checking your smartphone.
Yeah, I've written about that intermittent reinforcement, it's called, in my column. And this is part of what makes somebody crazy for another person, that sometimes that person comes around, but mostly they don't. But there's sometimes there's that one little ray of light. And that's what it takes for some people to get obsessed.
Yeah. No, that's right. And so, you know, we get that, with those intermittent reinforcement schedules, we then have to protect ourselves from ourselves, you know. So actually, you know, breaking the habit of checking your smartphone all the time, that's one of the habits that if each of us went out of our way to break that, our lives would suddenly get so much better. We would notice more of the world. We would actually have some time to engage with our fellow person. But it's actually going to be a lot of work, because most of us have built up such a clear habit to do that it's an interesting case study in behavior change.
Well, this is one of the things I really like about your book, and I'm talking with Dr. Art Markman. His book is Smart Change: Break the Habits That Hold You Back and Form the Habits of Success. Now, I've done this. I realized I don't need to look at my phone all the time. I'm not such a big phone person anyway. I train my friends never to call me. So, you know, you engage with people in a bar or wherever. You don't have to be looking at something. You could be looking off into the distance and seeing who walks in. And it really is It really is rewarding, but you have to, I think, realize all these things we do, and just realizing how we get obsessed could maybe, I think, help somebody get out of an obsession, realizing that they're just a rat in clothes, being intermittently reinforced.
Absolutely. But luckily, we're rats with really big frontal lobes, so we actually can plan our way out of this. You know, and that's the beauty of it. The rat never figures out it's pressing the bar because it's been told to. And we actually have the opportunity to do that. And it's when we do that that we have to put ourselves in the best possible situation then to change our behavior so that we're able to overcome our own bar-pressing tendency.
Now, I want to get into rewards a little bit. You write that it's frequently suggested in articles that without a reward, there won't be a habit, but you say these discussions confuse mechanisms the brain uses to form a habit with the formula you need to follow to create a habit. So explain that, because that sort of sounds similar.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an interesting thing. If you look at the neuroscience, in order to study neuroscience, it's very important that we have something in the outside world that we can correlate against brain activity. And so early on, when we looked at a lot of the neuroscience that looked at rats, tended to use habit learning in which there was a behavior that a rat would perform, and then the rat would get rewarded for that. And then there was a signal in the brain that was correlated with that reward. And so it became known as the reward signal. Turns out, if you look carefully at what that signal is doing, it isn't really about reward. It's the signal that your brain uses to say, something unexpected just happened. You need to learn something right now. You need to learn to do this. So if you think about, for example, walking into your house and flipping on a light switch, the very first time that you do that, you flip on the light switch and the light goes on. And even though you cognitively know that the light was supposed to go on, your motivational system doesn't know that. It doesn't really have connection to all of these fancy areas of your brain that think. And so it simply notices you performed an action, and then lo and behold, this weird thing happened. The light went on. And so it gets a signal telling it, learn that so that you can do it again. Now, there's nothing deeply rewarding about having a light go on. It's just a signal that tells your brain, learn this. Well, what happened is in rats, because we studied this in rats and we used reward most of the time, this thing became known as the reward signal. And so what happened is lots of people, many of whom aren't really scientists who've decided to write about habits, have said, you know what, there's a reward signal. That must mean that rewards are a really important part of creating habits. So if I'm going to create a habit, I have to reward myself when I do that. And the fact is, you don't have to do that. And in fact, giving yourself little rewards along the way when you're trying to build a habit can actually get in the way sometimes of building habits. And so you really just need to repeat that behavior in a consistent environment over time. And that's really what you need to build up the habit.
No, wait, that's very interesting. Rewards can get in the way. Tell us how.
Yeah, so, you know, the funny thing is that at the end of the day, we need to perform behaviors because they bring about outcomes that we want, and we need to learn to do those things mindlessly. Now, what happens is if I repeatedly pair this behavior with a particular reward, and then I stop giving myself the reward, the habit learning system says, wait a second, this behavior is not working anymore. I used to get M&Ms every time I did this, and now I don't get M&Ms anymore. And you don't want that. So what you really need to do is to make sure that you're repeating the behavior that you actually want to perform and to obtain the outcomes that you really want to have, regardless of whether there's some extra thing that you cognitively would think of as being rewarding. Because once you stop doing that, once you stop giving yourself that reward, your motivational system is now going to say, wait a second, I'm getting ripped off here.
Right. Now, that reminds me of that research on kids. If you reward kids to do something like reading that you want them to find enjoyable, they're looking for the payout. It's not an enjoyable activity. It's something that they need to be paid off for. It changes in
sure.
the mind.
Yeah, you know, and of course, with people, it's even worse than it is with rats, right? With rats, they don't reason about the task too much. But kids, I mean, as far as I know. But kids start thinking about stuff, and they begin to realize really quickly. I mean, it's like the old Tom Sawyer thing, right? If you have to pay me to read, it must not be a very good thing to do. But if the kid has to pay you to read, well, now that must be a great activity.
Now, I want to talk about how you know you have a habit. We think that we just know, but you write that there are four key signatures of people who are doing something by habit. And I'll run through these and I'll have you talk about them. One is they're not aware what triggered them to start the action. Number two, they can perform the habit while doing more effortful things at the same time. You talked a little bit about that. Number three, habits are easily disrupted by changing the environment. And number four, because you can do certain behaviors mindlessly, have no memory for doing them at all. So, okay, so just through those. You know these, so I won't have to go through them again. But just tell us a little bit about this. Like, how do we know we have a habit?
Yeah, so, you know, the funny thing is, right, I mean, we live so much of our life mindlessly that actually we begin to lose track of the number of things that we're doing that are being done by habit. And so every once in a while when you're trying to change your habits, you actually need to step back and say, well, wait a second, have I got a habit at this moment? And some of it is, you know, that there are elements of the environment that are driving that behavior. And it becomes really important sometimes to begin to figure out what those elements are, particularly when you get to the point where you want to change your behavior. So for example, you know, I used to bite my nails when I was a kid. No matter what my mom did, I would still bite them. And when I finally got to graduate school, decided I needed to stop biting my nails, and I actually started observing myself, and I discovered that I used to bite my nails when I was sitting at my desk reading. But it required understanding what the triggers were to help me understand, what I had, what was going on with the behaviors. And the environment, you know, I mentioned the environment there, so I'll talk about that. That's a really critical part of your habitual behaviors, because you are basically associating the environment with the behavior, and we've talked a lot about that. Now, one of the other points that you mentioned that's really important is having a habit allows you to do something while you're doing something else more effortful. In other contexts, I rail endlessly against multitasking, which is the bane of modern existence. And the one exception to multitasking is that if you turn one of your behaviors into a habit, then you can multitask. So the reason that you can type while you're thinking is because if you've practiced your typing enough and now you're a touch typist and you don't have to think about typing because it's automatic, it's a habit, then you can type while you're trying to compose something else. And let's see, and then memory, that's the last bit. You know, the funny thing about having a habit is you do it long enough and now you can perform whole behaviors without any memory whatsoever that you did them. And my absolute favorite example of this is the house I used to live in. I just moved a couple of months ago, but before that, I used to routinely walk in the house and by habit shut the garage door with the switch. You know, I had an automatic garage door opener, and I would hit the switch and I'd come in the house, and then my wife would say to me, "Well, did you shut the garage door?" And I had no idea whatsoever whether I'd done it or not. I would routinely have to open the door and look outside and see if I'd shut the door, and often I had. So I got so tired of checking that we finally cut a window between the house and the garage so that I could just look and say, yes, it's closed, because I really had no memory at all for having done it.
That is so funny. Yeah, I have a lot of cases where there are habitual things I do where my mind is just like a trash compactor, and I've done them, and I can't remember. I have no idea, and it's sort of amazing. And what you say about multitasking, God, that seems so true. I really see it, and I try not to do it because I know it's so dumb. You sort of do a lot of things badly. If I'm multitasking, I will sometimes have to make my coffee over, which I hate because it takes a while. I have a whole process of the milk foamer and the thing and the, you know, because I've left out some step, like, for example, not putting the coffee in the little filter thing. I just pour through hot water and then I have no water left and I have to boil the water again, but the milk is already made. It's so annoying. So I try to pay attention, you know, because it really costs you more to not pay attention.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But somehow, you know, the modern world promotes all this multitasking. People tell you it's a good idea, and really, you know, with smartphones and computers and all this other stuff, that we're constantly being bombarded with things. So the only time you're allowed to multitask is if you've turned one of these things into a habit.
I want to talk about your smoking study when we come back, but this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Art Markman. His book is Smart Change, Break the Habits That Hold You Back and Form the Habits of Success. Now, this smoking study you did, it's so interesting. You write that when a goal becomes active, the GO system, the one that helps you create all those habits, makes you more likely to notice information in the environment that will support your habits to achieve that goal. So tell us about your
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, your motivational system is really, really efficient. It's really very good at what it does. And so when you engage a goal, it really tries to help you as much as possible to achieve that goal. And one of the ways that it does that is that it focuses you on information in the environment that will help you to achieve that goal. So we did some studies with cigarette smokers, one of my favorite studies. So we did this in Germany because I had a colleague, Miguel Brendel, who he and I did this research together, and he was in Germany, and the beauty of doing this in Germany is that there are more smokers in Germany, and so we didn't have to look as far to get people to be in the study. So we ran this study after a long lecture class, because even in Germany you're not allowed to smoke in the lecture hall, and so some people we took outside after the lecture, and we let them smoke a cigarette so that their need to smoke went down. And other people, we made them sit inside the classroom, and we gave everyone a cup of coffee. For the people outside, it was just to get them to sit long enough that the nicotine would diffuse through their system. For the people inside, it was because coffee is really strongly associated with smoking. And for those people, the combination of the wait after class and having that cup of coffee really drove up their need to smoke. And then we gave them the opportunity to buy some raffle tickets. And the raffle, the prize in the raffle was either cash or cigarettes, and it turns out that if you really need a cigarette, there's a tendency for you to want to pay more money to buy a raffle ticket if you really need to smoke than if you don't. But the really big effect, and this is the one that I love, is that if you desperately need a cigarette, then you are monumentally uninterested in a raffle that will allow you to win cash, relative to just having smoked a cigarette. And the idea is that you become so single-mindedly focused on achieving your goal that all sorts of other potentially valuable things in the environment, like money, cease to be important to you, because your motivational system is just trying to focus you on what it is that you need to do to achieve the goal that it's engaged. And that's why it's so hard to stop yourself once that goal has gotten engaged by the motivational system.
And I want to talk about our stop system. It's so fascinating. You write about why behavior change is so hard, and you say that some of the most difficult behaviors to change involve stopping a behavior rather than starting a new one. So it's a negative goal. And that's very, very hard for us.
Yeah, you know, it's in fact, if you look at the way that you frame the goals that you try to change, and if you look at the goals that people try to achieve year after year, for example, at New Year's, almost all of them, they fail at the moment they make the decision to pursue that particular goal, because they frame it negatively. So they say things like, I'm going to stop smoking, I'm going to check my email less. You know, it's all things that they're not going to do anymore. And there are two problems that come about with framing your goals in this negative way. One of them is that you're relying on the stop system to do all the work for you. So if you say, I'm going to stop smoking, what that says, in every situation where I used to smoke, now I'm going to have to rely on that stop system to tell me, don't smoke, don't smoke, don't smoke. And the problem is that stop system is prone to failure. Our frontal lobes are just not nearly as efficient as these mechanisms deep inside the brain that drive our behaviors. And so, you know, if you've ever seen the movie Airplane, for example, you know, Lloyd Bridges plays that character who's really under a lot of stress. And throughout the movie, he keeps going back to habits of his, right? So it's, I picked the wrong week to stop smoking, picked the wrong week to stop drinking. You know, by the end of the movie, I think it's, I picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue, right? And it's all because that stress just impairs the way the stop system works. So that's one problem. And then the second problem is that even when I successfully stop myself, I can't learn a new habit to not do something. Because if you think about it, we're constantly not doing things. You don't learn anything when you don't do something. You only learn something when you do something. And so one of the things that's really important when you're going to change your behavior is to focus yourself on the positive changes you want to make. And I don't mean positive in the kind of, ooh, this is a great thing for the world kind of thing. I mean positive in the sense that you're actually performing a behavior, because it's only when you perform a behavior in a consistent environment repeatedly that you can develop a habit. And so you want to put yourself in a situation in which you're actually doing something that could create a new habit, because the best way to change your behavior is to have a new habit and not to ride the brakes all the time.
Well, with smoking, what would that new habit be? What would you do instead of having the negative habit?
Well, rather than telling yourself, I'm going to stop smoking, what are some other positive behaviors you could perform? I mean, and it could be several, right? So maybe I'm going to chew gum in certain contexts in which I used to smoke. And maybe I'm going to go out for a walk at some of the times of day when I used to smoke. And maybe I'll actually take up running. Because if I start running, then suddenly, smoking gets in the way of that because it makes it harder for you to build up any endurance. And so the idea is to pick up other behaviors, each of which is a positive behavior and each of which interferes with a different part of the smoking process. And don't feel like it has to be one behavior. Just because you're trying to quit one behavior doesn't mean you're going to replace it with only one other thing.
Right, but I think that that's a very important point, that you need to replace something you're not doing with something you do. Very, very important, because
right.
It seems that that is very helpful. And I just actually wanted to mention, you talked about how the New Year's resolutions, and I had Roy Baumeister on my show, and he wrote a book, Willpower, with John Tierney. And one thing that really struck me from that book is how he says, don't have resolutions, have a resolution, because you write about this, Baumeister and Vos found that we have a limited amount of mental effort. It's called ego depletion, that you run out of willpower, basically, to stop yourself from doing things.
Yeah, so, riding the brakes is just a dangerous thing. I mean, there are so many different things that interfere with the stop system. So I already mentioned stress, and certainly drugs and alcohol will do that too, which is one of the reasons why we end up doing all kinds of goofy things when we've been out drinking. Not me, of course, but someone might do that. The last bit is this idea of ego depletion. And the idea is, look, because this system is relatively inefficient, if I have to repeatedly ride the brakes during the day, let's say I have a bad day at work, my boss is sitting over my shoulder the whole day, and I'm just using every ounce of that willpower that I have, of that stop system, to keep myself from snapping at my boss. When I finally get home and I open up the freezer and there it is, that I love that single serving carton of Ben and Jerry's, I see that and man, it just leaps out. And the next thing I know, it's me, a spoon, the TV set, and I'm off to the races, because no matter how much I might not want to do that, that ego depletion has really tired out. It's made less effective that whole stop system.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to realize that when they're hungry, when they're tired, that they're going to be weak-willed, so they can really look to not be in situations where they're tired or depleted in those ways. If they're trying to stop something, it's particularly important when you're trying to stop something.
Yeah, and you know what? And have a plan. And I talk a lot about this in the book, and there's a whole journal in the book I ask people to fill out, because you got to do some work if you're going to change your behavior. And one of the things that's really important is to have a plan for what you're going to do, perhaps in a situation in which you are a little bit depleted for some reason, because those days are going to happen, and you don't want to lose the war just because you got a little bit tired. So what are you going to do? Is there a friend that you can phone? Bring a list of things to do, right? Because lists are great. you know, at the supermarket, for example. You go to the supermarket when you're hungry, and all manner of food that you didn't plan on buying leaps into the cart without you knowing it. But it turns out if you bring a list to the supermarket, then no matter how depleted you are, no matter how much you need to eat, you'll stick to the plan because you've got something outside of yourself, that list that you can look at and keep yourself on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, and you bring up that it's particularly important to look at what obstacles you'll be facing, make a picture of them in your head, picture how things could be, but also picture what's going to get in the way, because then you can deal with it. If you're not just faced with, oh, there's an obstacle, what a surprise, if you think, oh, I expected that, that's much better.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, my least favorite book is The Secret. So The Secret says, you know, think positive thoughts, and leaving aside the mystical, I'm gonna resonate with the positive energy of the universe. The problem with only thinking positive thoughts is that actually the people who succeed at really changing their behavior are the ones who are remarkably good at talking themselves out of doing things. Only instead of talking yourself out of doing something, you find all of those reasons not to do it, and then you plan for them. Because if you're prepared, if you're ready for everything that life has to bring to you, then it can't beat you, right? You're going to have a plan for all of those things that are going to come up, all of those obstacles, and you're going to be ready for them. And that is a great thing. Although, I'll slip this in here, you also have to be kind to yourself. Because no matter how prepared you are, no matter how good you are, no matter how hard you try, you are going to fail sometimes. You're going to overeat when you're on a diet. You're going to have a cigarette even though you're trying to quit smoking. You're going to yell at your kids or your spouse when you're trying not to. And in those instances, you have to make sure that you treat yourself with a little bit of kindness and recognize that everyone fails at stuff every once in a while, and that that's not a reason to give up. Failure is a reason to learn something about why you failed and not a reason to give up trying.
Yeah, I've talked about this before on the show. Albert Ellis, who founded cognitive behavioral therapy with Aaron Beck, he advised admitting that we're human, we're fallible. You know, and if you do that, then failing is an of course. Of course I'm going to fail because I'm human and fallible. I think that that's really, really important to do, because then you can engage in that what's called self-compassion that you write about, that you're just talking about, where you're just kind to yourself and where you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You write about this too, talking about, oh, you failed one day. Okay, forget the diet, you know, because you ate ice cream, you ate the carton of Ben and Jerry's one night, you know, that you can just say, well, I'm going to do better tomorrow. I'm human. I'm fallible. I had my moment of humanity tonight. Tomorrow I'm going to be stronger, I hope.
Yeah, and not just tomorrow, I hope I'm going to be stronger. What went wrong tonight? You know, this is a learning experience. So what happened tonight? You know, what was the circumstance? Did I have a hard day at work? Was I trying to celebrate something? You know, let me learn from this situation and learn so that I can plan for this again in the future, so that I don't just assume that every time this situation comes up, that's going to be the night when I eat all the ice cream. You know, there's something in the book I write about called the what the hell effect, which is basically, you know, just because you've broken a diet or had a cigarette or whatever it is, doesn't mean that you're now not a dieter anymore, now you're a smoker again, whatever it is. You know, the what the hell effect is basically, just because I lost the battle, you know, if I then give up and lose the war as well, then I've completely given up on things. But when I recognize that I am fallible, that I am human, and that failures are just learning experiences, then I get right back up on it the next time and continue on instead of giving up.
Yeah, I think that's a wise message. And I just wanted to get into some plans you give to deal with the obstacles in the book. I think these are great examples. This is somebody who's dieting. So say they're at a buffet and they're going to start this weight loss plan, or they've just started. And then you suggest, well, go up after everyone's taken a first trip, you know, because that way they'll all be, you know, they'll be done eating by the time you finish eating. You're not going to go back for a second, so you'll be less likely to. Or another example you give is to look for the smallest plate available, because we're lazy, we don't want to go back up there, you know, and you generally eat the food you put on your plate, so have a smaller field area of food.
Yeah. I tell everybody, look, go to the dessert cart, but not for the desserts, for the plates, because they put all the small plates there. Everyone rushes to get online at the buffet. You know, don't do that. Let everybody else get online. This way, all the really yummy stuff got picked over, and now you get the dregs of what's left. You fill your small plate. Sit far away from the buffet, face away from it, talk with people. You know, you do all that. Now by the time you finish your food, that they've cleared the buffet out. You know what? I read a lot of different kinds of things when I was putting this book together, and some of them were just popular folk who said a lot about habits. And, you know, Jack LaLanne was so great about this stuff. He passed away actually while I was writing the book. And one of the, you know, he talked about the fact that the greatest exercise you can perform is pushing yourself away from the table. And I love that when it comes to something like weight loss. You know, the idea that we really need to develop some habits to you know, you can't say I'm going to stop eating, but you can perform the positive action of saying I'm done. I'm pushing myself away from the table, bringing my plate, you know, up and putting it away.
And I just wanted to say too that besides planning for the obstacles, that to deal with obstacles, you also had positive plans. And you told another story I really liked about a guy who went to networking events who had 10 business cards in his pocket, and he had to give them out to people he had never met before, so he wouldn't just stick to the people he knew.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because I wrote this book with an eye towards both people's day-to-day habits like losing weight, but also really thinking about what happens in the business world. I spend a lot of time talking with people in companies about habits, you know, and actually the fascinating thing about things like networking events is that there's actually a twofold problem with them. And I met this guy and he had such a great story, so I had to include this in the book. He did two things, right? The one was he found he would go to these networking events and he would talk to the same people over and over because he was always afraid that if he bumped into a friend of his that they would feel they would be miffed if he didn't spend some time talking to them. And so he would look through the list of people who were likely to attend an event, and he would contact some of those folks that he thought he was going to bump into there and set up a meeting for the day, the several days after the event. This way, he knew he was going to be seeing them, and that gave him the opportunity to walk up to them and just say a quick hey, and, you know, I'm looking forward to having coffee with you next week, and move on and make sure that he gave away at least 10 cards, which was the positive action to do to new people and actually make contacts. Because so many of us go to these events, and we end up talking only with people we know, and then we leave and realize we haven't actually fulfilled the purpose of being at these networking events.
Yeah, that's wonderful, that story. When we come back, I want to talk about the environment, go back to the chapter I read that got me to change my vitamin D taking behavior. But first, this is Advice Goddess Radio, Amy Elkhorn. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Art Markman, and his book is Smart Change, Break the Habits That Hold You Back and Form the Habits of Success. So the environment. And this was so fascinating to me, and I realized you're right about this. You said chances are we all brush our teeth regularly, and many people floss less regularly. Talk about how the bathroom environment supports brushing and not flossing. I love that.
Yeah, I freely admit I'm a 4 week a year flosser really. I go to the dentist twice a year, and I floss the week before I go to the dentist in fear and the week after in shame. And I think the real reason for this is because we don't have furniture for floss. So if you think about your bathroom, you have furniture for almost every other aspect of your oral care needs, right? You have a little cup to put your toothbrush in. You have a place to put your toothpaste. Everything is out in the environment. And so when you're mindlessly getting yourself up in the morning or ready for bed at night, everything that you need is there except the floss. Because floss is designed in a container that screams out, throw me in a drawer. And so you do. You get that floss. You know, you get floss from the dentist after you go. You might even go out of your way to buy some. But then you put it in a drawer somewhere, and it's just not out. And that means that you don't think about it for weeks on end. And even when you try to put it out, it looks so ugly that it's hard to keep it in the right place for long enough to actually develop the habit. So I think if we had more furniture for floss, we'd have a better generation of flossers.
You should be able to buy a spool of floss, put it in a nice little ceramic container, just come out the top. I mean, there should be, you know, these nice ceramic floss containers.
Yeah, this is a business opportunity waiting for your readers to your listeners to capitalize on.
Listeners, readers, or we can go into business together and make floss containers. I think my boyfriend will commit, he'll kill himself if I do anything different. He's already trying to manage all the other stuff I do. I want to talk a little bit more about environment. You say that you can change your environment to remove obstacles, and this is actually true even of an environment that's not yours. And you talk about a hotel room that you stayed in that had a treadmill and a set of dumbbells in the room. It cost a little more, but you felt it was worth it to stay there.
Oh yeah, you know, if you know, anyone who travels a lot, and you know, people in our business, we travel a lot. You know, you try and work out when you're on the road, and quite frankly, right, the what passes for a fitness center at most hotels is three broken treadmills and a TV set, but I finally found a hotel that actually would give you a room that had the treadmill in it, and it had some dumbbells in it. It was great. Because, you know, at the end of a long day, I'm as good as anybody else when I'm on the road at talking myself out of trying to exercise. But if it's sitting right there in your environment staring at you, you know, at some point you just have to jump on it. And then you feel better once you've done it. But you have to make it easy for yourself. I mean, the real principle behind using the environment to influence your behavior is to make the desirable behaviors easy and the undesirable behaviors hard.
And now you mentioned a very interesting term, protected values, as a way to avoid doing something. And I'll give you an example of my own. I say that I'm from the culture of people who don't eat potatoes. And so I use that to not eat delicious French fries sitting right in front of me. So tell us about protected values.
Yeah, so a protected value is basically drawing a line in the sand. It's the kind of thing you absolutely will not do under any circumstances. And a protected value is kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it says, you know, you can use it the way, you know, you've just described, and you can sometimes use it very powerfully to say, look, this is the thing I absolutely won't do. You know, I absolutely just won't eat potatoes or whatever it is. And that can be a great way of influencing your behavior, except that you have to be really careful when you fail. Because if you fail on one of those protected values, that creates the potential danger for the what the hell effect. Because that's one of those things where if you've divided the world up into black and white, as long as you stay on the white side of the line, everything is fine. But as soon as you cross over, you know, the black side of the line is everything from the border between white and black all the way beyond. And so, you know, you run the risk if you create a protected value against potatoes that someday you're going to wake up in a mass of tater tots.
Well, I know better than to say I'm a person who doesn't stop her writing to go on Twitter because that's I'm going to fail. But the potatoes thing I can do, I just manage that because I think about it, actually some of the stuff you talk about, the positive that it's I want to be healthy and I know about the science of low carb. And so that's the thing that I can do that I can specifically say without failing at it because I don't want to fail because then I feel bad, even though I know I'm fallible and human and all that. And one thing in this sort of neighborhood also is Carol Dweck's work. She talks about talents versus skills. We talked about this on the show before about how skills or abilities, they depend on effort, talents inborn. So you say that we treat the stop system. You say we advise that we treat the stop system like a skill.
Yeah. So, you know, I love Carol Dweck's work. She and I were colleagues together at Columbia University for a while before she went off to Stanford and I went here to UT. And, you know, the work that she does to really, you know, influence people's mindsets, to let them know that almost everything mental is actually a skill that can be acquired is really important. And I think that the same thing holds true with the stop system. You know, we can hear about things like ego depletion and think, oh, it's hopeless. I can never learn to overcome this. But there's actually a little bit of evidence now, a growing amount of evidence, suggesting that if we recognize that even our willpower is a skill that can be strengthened and that we can learn other skills to help us to overcome temptations, not just relying on the stop system per se, but also, you know, having those plans for the obstacles that are going to come up, that when we do that, we actually can make ourselves better at resisting temptations in the long run.
One technique I use that I've talked about before on the show is using a timer, because when your writing's not going too well, you want to do anything but write. That's when you start worrying about dust bunnies under things, and believe me, I'm not a duster. So I use this timer. It goes for an hour, and I have to keep writing until the hour is done. And what generally happens is eventually you come up with something that isn't idiotic and unfunny, and you start to like it. You get into what's called flow, and you start to have a good time. But even if that doesn't happen, it gets me to do an hour of work where if I didn't have the timer going, I would just sort of do something else.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, almost every successful person in the creative pursuits has some kind of routine that they go through to keep them at their creative pursuit, even on the days when it doesn't feel like it's going very well. You know, almost every you look at these websites that talk about the habits of creative people, and they all get up first thing in the morning and they spend whatever it is. For some it's an hour, for some it's 2 hours, but whatever it is, they really force themselves into that situation to make something happen, whatever it is, knowing that the skills that they've developed in their pursuit will eventually kick in and get them doing the right thing.
Yeah, I do that. I wake up at 5 to write, which is not my favorite time in the world, but it's just you write better, you have better energy then, and it's important to maintain that routine in order to be in the practice of writing and not in the habit of shirking.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we are almost out of time. I just want to ask you for any final words of wisdom to leave us with about smart change.
You know, I would say there are two things. The first is make sure that you don't change your behavior alone. Engage the people around you. Remember that not only are we a fallible species, but we're also a social species, and we do everything better in groups. And so that's one. And then the other is make sure you're willing to do the work. And as I mentioned, there is a journal that I have in the book. It's actually freely available on my website, so you don't even have to buy the book, but you can get the journal for free. And I encourage you to really, you know, if you're interested in actually making change this time instead of deciding you think you might possibly want to make change, get ready and be willing to do the work.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I have been talking with psychologist and researcher Dr. Art Markman, and his book is Smart Change, Break the Habits That Hold You Back and Form the Habits of Success. I think that's a very good idea. Art, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. And good luck with your book launch this week.
Thank you. Good manners for nice people sometimes say, Fox, get it in stores this week.